continuing the attempt to summarize the divine science of the Bible. The Four Gospels, recorded Easter 1989. Gordon Brown.
This spiritually colossal idea, then, with which we are engaged, to which we are devoting and consecrating our lives, for which, in the words of the textbook, we are laying our earthly all on the altar of divine science, in order to be endued with the spirit and power of Christian healing. And in view of all that claims to be building itself up in mortal thought today, it's increasingly imperative, isn't it, that we do dedicate our lives to it. So shall we just state once more what the idea is that becomes more and more spiritually exciting to us the further it unfolds? The aspect of the idea, the view of it, which you and I are specifically concerned with at this moment, is, as we know, no less than a taste, a glimpse of the divine science of the scriptures, seen today all the way from Genesis to Revelation. The Old Testament, that is, from Genesis to Malachi, flowing without a break into the New Testament, and then right the way through from Matthew to Revelation. It's more beautiful, more regenerative, more fraught with divine promise and certitude than possibly at the present stage of our development we are able to realize. But we're doing our best, aren't we? And the point we've actually reached in this spiritual journey, and which we're going to concentrate on today, the sublime moment of the four Gospels. And probably an inspired new look at them. Where not only do we glory in what historically Jesus accomplished some 2,000 years ago, but because we are privileged now to begin to understand what he did from the standpoint of its divinely impersonal, universal science, we see it applying not only to our own lives individually, but to our world universally, healing, transforming, translating consciousness from mortality to immortality, from time into eternity, from personal sense to spiritual sense, and therefore the means of our and mankind's salvation from sin, disease, and death. And the journey we're making is in no way a space-time journey, of course, even though to human sense it looks as if we're traversing vast tracts of scriptural text and that it's taking us a long time to do it. Rather, it's a spiritual and mental journey, isn't it? Taking place solely as the unfolding of consciousness. Which means that in starting out from Genesis, we're not really moving in a straight line until we reach our destination in Revelation, but are describing scientifically a vast and glorious life circle all the way around to Revelation, so that when at last we do reach Revelation, we find ourselves back at the point where we started out from. That's to say, our origin in Genesis, and our ultimate in Revelation, are metaphysically the same place. Just as when Jesus said how he came forth from the Father, the all-embracing divine principle love, and returned to the Father. Solving individually, as he made this circular journey, the universal problem of mortality. Now let's just hold to that, may we? Solving individually the universal problem. And let's realize too how the entire historical span of the 7,000-year periods, as they range, both biblically and in terms of world civilization, from Genesis to Revelation, is precisely focused in the life mission of Jesus as it ranges from the Nativity to the Ascension. And how his mission comes at the opening of the Bible's 5,000-year period, corresponding therefore with the fifth day of creation, with its accent on eternal, deathless life, the fifth synonymous term for God in the fundamental order of being. Yes, because wonderfully enough, just as the career of Jesus focuses demonstrably the huge scriptural unfoldment from Genesis to Revelation, and therefore from the individual standpoint illustrates the entire process of world salvation, so Jesus' own sevenfold career from the Advent to the Ascension is itself pinpointed precisely in the fifth stage of that career, where he demonstrates, by means of the crucifixion and resurrection, the forever allness of life on the one hand, and the forever nothingness of death on the other. At that supreme moment, he brings to a spiritual focal point the entire cosmic life principle as it applies not only to himself individually, but also to the whole of mankind, individually, collectively, universally, including you and me. And it's lovely, isn't it, that if we were to go to the piano and play what is called the diatonic scale, in whatever key, the fifth note of that sevenfold scale, as it leads to a new beginning at the point of the eighth note, the octave, is called, what? The dominant. Because certainly the 5,000-year period, opening with the mission of Jesus, the fifth day of creation, the fifth synonymous term in the fundamental divine order, all focused in the career of Jesus. And his career itself brought to a glorious focus at the point of the fifth stage of its development, is by reason of what the emphasis is at this point, namely eternal, indestructible life, utterly dominant, utterly dominant in its meaning and importance, whatever view of the scale we're looking at. So can we appreciate, therefore, that when this dominant note is sounded, standing for the demonstration of eternal, deathless life, it epitomizes in itself the full span of the scale from the first note, the tonic, corresponding to the nativity, to the seventh note called, do you know, the leading note, corresponding to the ascension. Because what this seventh note or leading note leads to is the fullness of the octave itself. Or where in the case of Jesus the ascension leads, in the words of Paul, to his being set down on the right hand of the Majesty on high. The problem of the birth-death cycle of mortality finally and forever resolved. In other words, the glory which he had with the Father, Mother, God before the world was, as the Gospel text puts it, is found to be the forever uninterrupted truth of his being, and therefore in science the truth of your and my being too. Well, I can't think of any more lovely illustration of this cyclic life journey of ours, which as it unfolds from Genesis to Revelation is without beginning or end, and is represented therefore not by a straight line, but by the unbroken continuity of a circle or sphere, than the one given in that wonderfully useful compilation called the Companion Bible. There, with reference to this same span of books from Genesis to Revelation. Because what the Companion Bible does is to liken these two books, the first and last in the canonical order, to the two buckles or clasps of a girdle or belt, such that when they join or are interlocked, the belt as a whole, the Bible as a whole, forms one continuous circle that encompasses the whole body. The body of all mankind. And therefore Genesis and Revelation become to us, don't they, two aspects of the same state of consciousness, namely the origin and ultimate, the Alpha and Omega of life itself. And just think of the point at which the clasps actually join, or where the one fits into the other and they interlock. In the case of Genesis, it's the 7 days of creation, isn't it, at the very beginning of the book? And in the case of Revelation, it's the city that lieth 4 square at the end of the book. Right? The two together, the 7 days and the 4 square city, form the point, therefore, where the joining up process is consummated and the two are securely wedded. And therefore, because the 7 days derive from what God the Infinite is constitutionally as mind, spirit, soul, principle, life, truth, love, And because the four sides of the holy city derive from the way in which mind, spirit, soul, principle, life, truth, love operate integrally as the Word, Christ, Christianity, science, we're at the point of conceiving the idea. Please let's actually be doing this as we sit here now. Conceiving the idea of the whole of cosmic being, encompassed, engirdled divinely by the wedded relationship of the seven and four capitalized conceptions of the oneness and eternality of the infinite. Can we do that lovingly, prayerfully, for our world as we sit here? Because what we are about to witness, to bear witness to, is this stupendous fact of sevenfold, fourfold unity individualized in its entirety in the life work of Jesus. And when science has explained to us what this life work truly means, spiritually and universally, individualized and focused in your life work and in my life work, in fact, in the life work of all mankind. So as Jesus says, I come forth from the Father, and I circle back to the Father, but I never leave the Father's presence as I do so. And what this means, in the words of the textbook, is that life, capital L, is the origin and ultimate of man. Jesus' only life, little L, and our only life, little L, is the one indivisible, indestructible life, capital L. Could anything be more wonderful to think about than that? One infinite, indivisible life, never broken up into a multitude of little finite, wearing out lives. And now to clinch this stupendous fact of the beginning and end of our life being thus one in identity, in this way, we couldn't do better, surely, than cite those marvelous words of Jesus to the disciples, as recorded in the apocryphal Gospel of Thomas, when he asked them, do you remember, to tell them what their end would be. And he replied, have you then discovered the beginning that you inquire about the end? For where the beginning is, there shall be the end. Blessed is he who shall stand at the beginning, and he shall know the end, and he shall not taste death. Blessed is he who was before he came into being. Isn't that wonderful? When the end and the beginning are the same place as they are in respect of Genesis and Revelation, no death. When the end end and the beginning are the same place spiritually, then no death. And therefore, blessed is he who was before he came into being. Does it remind us, perhaps, of those other words of Jesus when, at the end of his career, at a point corresponding to the seventh day of creation, he said how he had finished the work which the Father had given him to do, that is, at the beginning. Glorify thou me with thine own self, he said, with the glory that I had with thee before the world was. Meaning, before that which I am divinely came forth to prove humanly the nothingness of what I am not, namely a mortal personality living and moving in a space-time universe. Because that word before, it doesn't merely mean in a time sense, therefore, does it? But rather the sense of a divinely prescribed order of being. Like, for example, the order in which the two phases of translation are given on pages 115 and 116 of the textbook. Scientific translation of immortal mind necessarily comes before scientific translation of mortal mind, doesn't it? But not, of course, in a time sense, because the two operate simultaneously. In the same way, in divine metaphysics and therefore in divine logic, divine science comes before Christian science. But this order of science has nothing to do with time. Basically, it's the relation, isn't it, of the divine to the human. The divine first, solving the problem of the human seeming to have cut itself off from the divine second. The divine original, before the human reflection, but not first the one and then the other in time. And therefore Jesus' insistence that it was the Father divinity that had sent him forth to minister to the needs of humanity. We see that, of course. And therefore, blessed is he who was divinely before he came into being humanly. Is that all right? Now, shall we just observe that today is the third time in this work with the divine science of the scriptures that we're using the tape recorder. The first occasion, you remember, was when we reached the end of the Old Testament and had seen something of the wonder of the vision of Israel's 16 prophets, and how these 16 prophets, in their two groups of 4 major prophets and 12 minor prophets, teach us no less than the living principle of the unity of the center and circumference of being. That right? a fourfold center and a 12-fold circumference, making up 1 16-fold, 1 4-square prophetic utterance. A four-square statement that is womb-like or matrix-like in its signification because it's essentially birth-giving. How marvelous. You remember Isaiah, the first of the prophets? Shall I bring to the birth and not cause to bring forth, saith the Lord? Shall I cause to bring forth and shut the womb, saith thy God? Because then it is that in the 16th and last prophecy, that of Malachi, the windows of heaven are said to be open and a blessing is about to pour itself forth on a world scale such that there isn't room enough to receive it. And this great universal blessing takes the form, doesn't it, of what are called the two advents of the world-saving Messiah. As the outcome of the fourth period of principle, which closes the Old Testament, the mission first of Christ Jesus that opens the New Testament and therefore the fifth period of life, leading secondly to the mission of Christian Science that comes in the course of the sixth and seventh periods characterized by truth and love. And it's this idea of the manhood and womanhood of God which specifically the four major prophets hold in prospect, don't they? At the very center of the world's true being, that the 12 minor prophets at the circumference bring to birth to the hungering, if you like, expectant consciousness of mankind. You see, as in the case of Mary relative to Jesus, you remember how in Hosea, God the Father sows the seed of this idea in the womb of human thinking, is sowing in the womb of your and my spiritual consciousness now, today, where it's conceived, where it gestates and develops until at the point of Malachi, there it is. In all its pristine purity, its wholeness and holiness, ready to be born and accepted by worldwide humanity. So do let's please affirm prayerfully that this receptivity and acceptance on the part of mankind is the underlying absolute truth regarding our world today. It's so important, isn't it? So then, what we sought to do on the first of the tape recordings was to make a spiritual summary of the whole of the Old Testament teaching that had prepared the way for this very moment now of Christly birth at the beginning of the New Testament. Is that correct? And you remember the marvelous thing we found was that like the first 4 days of creation, in the way in which these days are presented in the chapter Genesis in Science and Health, the first 4,000 thousand-year periods of the Bible that make up the Old Testament unfold basically through a specific number of outstanding scriptural events, textual subdivisions in the actual text, if you like, that correspond to those into which the days of creation are subdivided in science and health. You agree with that? That's to say, three main spiritual tones, as we call them, in the first period, three again in the second period, five in the third period, and five again in the fourth. At which point, the Old Testament comes to an end. Now, how many is that altogether? Three, three, five, five, precisely 16. That's right. And the number of prophets that gather up and consummate all that the Old Testament teaches is likewise 16. It's really wonderful, isn't it, that that should be so? It's what I think would be called today contextual logic, probably, which is such a lovely thought. Contextual logic. So the symbol unfolded by the Old Testament becomes that of a four-square, 16-fold matrix or mother state of consciousness, foreshadowing the eventual city four-square, the New Jerusalem in Revelation, which Paul defines as the mother of us all. So what we have before us then is the prophets at the end of the Old Testament bringing forth the mission of Jesus, and Revelation at the end of the New Testament itself prophesying the mission of Christian Science. In other words, of the womb of the Father, Mother, God at the close of the fourth period of principle is born in the course of the fifth, sixth, and seventh periods of life, truth, and love, the manhood and womanhood of the one divine Son of the one Father, Mother, God, the only begotten Son of God in his two aspects as the manhood and womanhood of God. So it was really this divine principle unfolded by the Old Testament that we attempted to epitomize on the first of the recordings, wasn't it? And then we thought that before we embarked in detail on the New Testament, we try to understand it, or perhaps rather to visualize it, if we could, in its overall spiritual meaning, and attempt to put this on tape too. And so that's how the second of the recordings came about. But because the New Testament is so brief compared with the Old, taking up historically no more than the first century of the Christian era, we thought we'd make it an opportunity to look outwards beyond the way the Bible tells the story and in very broad outline try to see God's divine purpose at work throughout the corresponding periods of the story of civilization itself. All the way through from the 4th millennium BC, when our present world movement had its inception, and where wonderfully enough, in the historicity of the Bible, the story of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden begins too, all the way through to today, when civilization stands on the threshold of its own spiritual goal. The seventh millennium of its history, corresponding, of course, to the seventh and last day of creation, or where the divinely revelatory purpose is represented as finished. But not finished, of course, in any finite or static sense, but rather the point where its infinite perfection continues to unfold forever. That is, to open out into a state of infinite progression. So on the second of the recordings, we decided to include this epitome from the spiritual point of view of the whole amazing story of world civilization itself, didn't we? And therefore, today, we're embarking on the third of these recordings and focusing on the four Gospels. It might be well at this point if we just turn to those two little diagrammatic charts which you have there in front of you. Yes? The first one, if you got it, to do with the 16 prophets, which you've just been referring to, and where the accent is on the divine principle itself. And the second to do with the four Gospels, where the accent is on this very principle showing itself forth as life eternal, the life of all real being. So as we glance at the first one, we see that circle, don't we, of the 12 minor prophets, who are like the 12 gates of the Holy Mother City in Revelation, and stand for what Malachi calls the open windows of heaven. Because the second one, to do with the Gospels, is where, as we merge from the fourth day of creation into the fifth, we find ourselves literally in the realm of this very open firmament of heaven, as the text itself expresses it in the fifth day of creation, whose waters are bringing forth abundant life. You see, the fish in the text of the fifth day stand for life at the point of its infinite origin. It's when Jesus said that he came forth from the Father, while the birds of the fifth day stand for this same divine life at the point of its eternal ultimate. It's when he said he returned to the Father as the source from which he originally came. No past, no present, no future then as time, and therefore no death. But no death is precisely what Jesus is about to prove as the great timeless principle of the 16 prophets, showing itself forth to be abundant, indestructible life. Because you remember how the textbook defines the state of mind of the prophet. That he knows the past, the present, and the future. And therefore, when we turn to the mission of Jesus itself, and the accent shifts from principle to life, we see this principle of timeless, fetterless life being demonstrated and proved before our very eyes. and the measure of the proof corresponds necessarily with the full measure of the 7 days of creation. And why? Because, says the textbook, it is these days which reveal eternity, newness of life, and can never, therefore, be reckoned according to the calendar of time. You remember that wonderful summary, it's on page 520 of the textbook, with reference to the 7 days of creation. They reveal eternity, newness of life, which is just what Jesus is about to do. And therefore the mission of Jesus, as you see it there on the little chart, unfolds from the Advent or the Nativity to the Ascension in accordance with this eternal, fundamental order of being called the 7 days of creation. In other words, the light of the world, which dawns at the beginning of the mission, finishes at the end the work which its principle has given it to do and is glorified. And in between the Advent and the Ascension, the sequence of steps is really so abundantly clear that it would be awfully difficult to miss the parallel. So how about it now, if we examine these steps one by one in their own beautiful divine order, from 1 to 7. Should we do that? First then, the light which shines at the point of the Advent, or Nativity. What is it really? It's really the outpicturing of the enlightenment conceived by the Virgin Mary, that God is the only Father, the only Creator, the only Author of man. So do we see the equivalent there of the first day of creation? And the second major event is recorded in the Gospel, the baptism. When he stands in the midst of the waters of Jordan, just like the firmament in the midst of the waters in the second day of creation, and like the ark of spiritual understanding which Noah builds in the 2,000-year period to save himself from the waters of the flood. It's signifying, you see, that the emphasis has moved from mind to spirit. From mind as his parental origin to spirit as the Holy Ghost or Spirit of God that comes down from the firmament called heaven in the second day of creation and submerges him in the understanding of what himself and his world in reality are. What his divinity is as the waters above, and what his humanity is as the waters beneath, that is, as spirit's own reflection of itself. Do we see that? But this fact of the coincidence of the human with the divine, the John the Baptist baptism in relation to the Holy Ghost baptism, demands to be proved in the human experience. It must be proved, that's to say, that the human, as divinity's own reflection of itself, is as pure, is as free from sin or the belief of separation from God, as is divinity itself. And so the third main event in Jesus' career is when that same Spirit of God driveth him, that's the way the text puts it, into the wilderness to be tempted of sin or Satan. It's where, as Paul says, he's tempted in all points like as we are, yet without sin. And what this means is that the tone has moved forward now from spirit to soul. Because now it is that divinity and humanity, subjective and objective, himself and his seemingly outside world, are one in identity. Just as heaven and its self-propagating earth are in the third day of creation, and just as Israel has to prove in the wilderness regarding her own self-propagating identity in the third thousand-year period. Otherwise, if she doesn't prove it, she'll never inherit the promised land at the end of the period, will she? And this means, most wonderfully, that he's now prepared, fourthly, for the era of his great public ministry, his spiritual understanding, the conscious reflection in his own identity of the order of God as mind, spirit, as soul, as revealed to him no less than the governing principle of the total universe. Like in the fourth day of creation, and like in the era of the kings and prophets in the 4,000-year period, God is absolutely all, capital A, reflected in all, little a. And the will of this all-powerful principle is reflected in earth, operates on earth, just the way it does in heaven. All there is to his apparently outside world, that's to say, is really his own inside Christly selfhood, one with God. Hence he can heal instantaneously every sickness and every disease among the people and perform all those wonderful works as we find them recorded in the gospel story. And what this means is that he can reach the fifth, the dominant tone, the supreme moment of his career, corresponding in meaning, of course, to the fifth day of creation, and in the big picture to his own fifth thousand-year period called the Christian era, to where he actually proves the deathlessness, the immortality, the indestructibility of life, not only for himself individually, but proves it to be true necessarily for the whole of the rest of mankind. He proves that there is no death, not a vestige of reality in the mortal birth-death cycle. You see, what he's always had to prove, isn't it, is that his own individuality is universal, all-inclusive, Otherwise, it isn't really individuality. It isn't spiritually indivisible. And therefore, it's only a limited, personal, segregated sense of individuality. And therefore, at the point of the crucifixion and resurrection, Jesus actually proves the allness of the tree of life, and therefore the nothingness of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, called the accursed tree or the tree of death. The so-called last enemy, death, having thus been destroyed, well, there are no more enemies. No further mortal problems needing to be resolved. And so the period between the resurrection and the ascension, in that period, he enters the sixth great moment of his mission, where his total dominion over all the earth and his hosts, just as man has in the sixth day of creation, and just as is vouchsafed to mankind as a whole through the coming of Christian Science in the 6,000-year period. We see that, don't we? I've overcome the world, he says at this point, and therefore he's glorified. So having proved conclusively now that the human is not subject to death and destruction, but only to progressive scientific translation, this means that he's reached the point of the final ascension. As in the seventh day of creation, and as in the 7,000-year period, the divine purpose relating to the salvation of the human concept from mortality is complete. Jesus has finished the work which the Father gave him to do, and so he rests on the right hand of the Majesty on high. But isn't this the very same position that he originally occupied before the world was? Indeed it is. The place which all the way along he's never consciously left, namely the continuity of his being in and of the order of divine science. Nothing, you see, but this continuity of life could have enabled him to prove from beginning to end with scientific certainty the total unreality of the mortal birth, death, time cycle. No interruption on the part of time and mortality of the cyclic order of divine science ever having really taken place. Isn't that terrific? Let's really take it to heart. And so, the question is, have we been able to glimpse there, in their own natural order, a little of the spiritual footsteps whereby the individual Jesus, on behalf of all mankind, solves the universal problem of dualistic mortality? Do you think we have? Good. Because it's very important that we should, isn't it? Otherwise, how will we be able to obey the command to go and do likewise? were we just to continue to gaze with a kind of mystical awe and reverence merely at the surface evidence of Jesus' momentous life work, how could we follow intelligently and scientifically the way it maps out for us? So let's just love, shall we, to penetrate further the surface evidence and seek the actual state of divine consciousness which is so obviously at work underneath? You remember that wonderful textbook statement of how Jesus plunged beneath the material surface of things and found the spiritual cause. Gorgeous to think that little by little we're being enabled to do the same thing, isn't it? To plunge beneath the material surface of things and find the spiritual cause. It's true. And how is it possible? Because the divine principle, and therefore the divine science of this state of consciousness, has in the course of the present 20th century begun to reveal itself. Because it's this revelation alone which enables us to understand for ourselves, to embody for ourselves, and therefore as ourselves, what it is that Jesus has unfolded and proved. No longer a matter of religious mysticism, but absolute order, science, and system. Marvelous to think of our beginning to conceive of our own identity as coming forth from, and therefore returning to in this way, the very same mind that was mind to Jesus. What else could possibly equip us to go and do likewise? In other words, it's the second advent of the Christ idea, appearing in its universal womanhood as Christian Science, that actually interprets for us the practical workings of the mission of its own individual manhood at the point of the first advent, and enables us to begin to follow individually and together this supreme example. But still there comes the question, how do we understand it and follow it in its science? And the answer is, of course, by understanding the way it's taught in the Christian Science textbook through those two essential complementary aspects of science called divine science and Christian science. So shall we for a moment just think of the way in which these different terms for science are used. Divine science, we see, is that which gives us the true idea, the God idea, of what divinity is. While Christian science gives us the true idea, the God idea, of what humanity truly is. So that in science itself, as the science of the world's real being? The two are found to be one in eternal coincidence. Science, golly, how marvelous. The infinite self-knowledge of God. Think of it. And hence the several terms which define what science is are said in the textbook to be synonymous terms for everything relating to God as mind. That's on page 127. The all-knowing mind. Mind, knowing the science of its own infinitude. Divine science, then. Science in the unity of its infinite divinity. Christian science, the reduction of divine science to a healing system of ideas that renders divine science comprehensible to humanity, that solves for us here and now the problem of mortal dualism, or of God and man, divinity and humanity, seemingly two instead of one. Well, clearly only that which is pure and absolute is capable of disposing of dualism. That is what appears to be an impure mixture of opposites. Therefore, in the textbook, on some five occasions only, reference is made to absolute Christian science, and each time implying that there's no death, and stressing therefore the standpoint of resurrection. Look them all up and you'll find that this is so. So let's bear in mind the absolute purpose of Jesus' mission to prove the allness of life and the nothingness of death. Now, interestingly enough, the very last statement written by Mrs. Eddy for the Sentinel late in 1910 included unequivocally, "Christian science is absolute." But the question is, can Christian science ever really be anything other than absolute? If its purpose is to afford humanity absolution from sin, disease, and death? Of course it can't. Just that when we think of this healing activity in process of taking place, the adjective absolute isn't required, and therefore the term that is paramount throughout the textbook is Christian science itself, without the additional qualification. We see that, I'm sure, don't we? Now, I see we're practically at the end of the first side of this tape, so we'll just pause there for a moment, turn the tape over, and then continue on the other side.